Terry Gross started out in public radio in 1973 at WBFO on the campus of SUNY Buffalo. She became producer and host of Fresh Air in 1975, when it was a daily local program in Philadelphia. Fresh Air went national in 1985 and won a prestigious Peabody Award in 1994 for, quote, probing questions, revelatory interviews, and unusual insights. In 2003, Terry Gross herself received public radio's highest honor, the Edward R. Murrow Award. Fresh Air is heard now on something like 414 NPR stations. The show has something like 4 million listeners every week. She's done more than 5,000 interviews. Now she's picked 36 of them for a book with the wonderful title, All I Did Was Ask, Conversations with Writers, Actors, Musicians, and Artists. She's one of my heroes, Terry Gross. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks, John. Thanks for saying that.
Well, before we talk about your book, I wanted to spend a little time on your shows during the political season that just ended.
Mm-hmm.
NPR is always accused by the right of being too liberal. And if you Google Terry Gross and too liberal, you get something like 100 websites.
No kidding. I've never tried that.
I did it this morning. I know that you strive for balance in your political coverage. The day after the election, for example, you had the liberal Rick Hertzberg and the conservative David Frum. You did an abortion rights show with a supporter and opponent. Bill Maher got balanced by Colin Quinn. But not everybody gets a balancing act. I don't think you balance Seymour Hersh or Richard Clark with people who said the CIA and the Bush administration had done a great job of fighting terrorism. So I wonder, how important to you are complaints that you are too liberal and that your show lacks balance? And how do you decide who requires a balancing act on the imposing side and who doesn't?
Yeah, good question. We have two different approaches to balance that we take. One is the balance within the show, where there's two people like David Frum and Hendrik Hertzberg talking about the election results. One's a Democrat, one's a Republican, and they're both within the same show. Other things, like before we went to war with Iraq, each individual show wasn't balanced because we'd have on lots of different people for weeks talking about Iraq. But our approach was over a period of a week or 2 weeks, over a period of time, it would be balanced. Because sometimes we like to devote the whole show to one person and, just give them that chance. Or sometimes the person who we really want on the other side isn't available on the same day. So we think that balance over time is an acceptable form also. Now, with somebody like Seymour Hersh, I don't think that he required balance per se in the sense that he's an investigative reporter. He had the scoop. He's the one who got the photographs, who got the story. And my interest there was in talking about the process of how he got it. And yes, there was some analysis thrown in there, too, but the interview with Hersh was in part a profile of Hersh. Often when somebody's on, we want to do a long interview with them and talk about not just the issue, but why they're involved with the issue. It ends up often to be more of a personal profile than a straight political piece. I'm sorry for going on like this, but it's
good. It's good.
it's not a simple
yeah.
answer, and it's something I would like everyone to know that we think about all the time. We don't have any easy, quick answers to this. We're always talking in the office, are we being fair? Is this balanced? And there's a lot of gray areas there. So I understand that a lot of people would disagree and think that there are times when we're not fair. But I think we're often dealing in gray areas where it's a judgment call and we make the best judgment that we can.
Now, I have a pet peeve about this balancing thing. Your hour with Michael Moore, which I thought was great, mm-hmm. was followed the next day by an hour with a guy named David Balsiger, who had made a video documentary about the faith of George W. Bush.
Exactly.
Now, Michael Moore won an Oscar, won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival. Fahrenheit 9/11 is the biggest grossing documentary in the history of the world. The guy you got for balance had none of that. He'd made a film that had no theatrical release. It had been shown at the Republican National Convention and then released on DVD, according to the Washington Post, was distributed by partisans who were giving the DVDs away at churches in the swing states. I'm sure that your show must have been the high point of David Balsiger's career for 4 million listeners. Why should that guy get a full hour on Fresh Air as some kind of equivalent to Michael Moore?
Well, that's a good question. We didn't see him as the filmmaking equivalent of Michael Moore in terms of his the impact of his work, although this isn't his first film. I mean, he's the vice president of Grizzly Productions, which has done like hundreds and hundreds of films that have been shown on broadcast television and on Christian networks. Many of them are Christian-oriented programs. So he's a real insider in the Christian in Christian culture. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he's hardly an equal of Michael Moore in terms of the popular impact that this movie has had. However, we wanted to have some political balance to what Michael Moore was saying, and we thought we didn't want the balance to be somebody who's making their professional career trying to go after Michael Moore. Like that was one approach. We can, you know, there's several documentaries that are just about attacking Michael Moore. We didn't want to head in that direction and just go into like personal attack against Michael Moore. So we wanted to find a movie that had a subject that saw Bush in a more positive light and talk to the filmmaker about it. And this seemed like a good bet because it was, you know, it was pretty interesting, I thought, to hear what he had to say about it. And then we talked to somebody whose group is represented in the movie, and he runs this group. He founded this group that is a prayer group, and the goal is to pray for the president and to pray for the people in the cabinet. And, I mean, that whole group raises some very interesting questions about religion and politics and the connection of the two.
Well, I have to admit that the interview that you aired with this guy, I had never heard of, David Balsiger, actually was a fascinating one, especially how he worked, what he had to say about Fahrenheit 9/11. As I recall, his main complaint was that it had low production values.
Oh, yes, I know. I thought, you know, that's one thing I really should have argued with him about, because say what you will about Fahrenheit 9/11, whether you like it or you don't like it, I think it's fair to say, a really well-produced movie and really interestingly edited.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other movie is a bunch of talking heads in various studios. So it's like, production value-wise, I think no matter what your politics are, you'd have to give Michael Moore the edge on that one.
One more question on the balance issue. You did a carefully balanced show on abortion at the end of August. Now, I imagine the overwhelming majority of your listeners are pro-choice. I imagine your whole staff at Fresh Air is pro-choice. Your anti-abortion guest was Senator Rick Santorum, Republican of Pennsylvania, who's one of the key sponsors of the so-called partial birth abortion ban. It's really hard for me to listen to that interview, and I'm sure I'm just kind of your average Fresh Air fan at this point. I wonder what it was like for you to do that interview with someone that you must have disagreed with on a really crucial issue.
Well, a couple of things on that. First of all, I have strong opinions on things, but I don't like to talk about them publicly because I always figure it's my job, if not to, I mean, I'm not sure objectivity is something that can really be achieved, but I think fairness can be. And I try to be as fair as possible on the air. And so I try not to talk about my own opinions because I think once people hear somebody's opinions, then I think it's difficult for them to imagine that person being capable of being fair. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah. Yeah. No. In fact, you were amazingly fair to him. You pressed him on very legitimate questions.
Right. Well, I mean that's my goal, is to, you know, when we're doing a show with two different points of view, to not let things that may be mistruths or exaggerations or out and out lies or hypocritical statements go unchallenged, but at the same time, if I have a point of view, to not press my point of view. It's not about me. It's not about my politics. It's not about my position. That doesn't mean that somebody gets a free ride if they're exaggerating or misstating the facts as we know them to be true.
Good. Well, one other question in pursuit of balance, and then I'll abandon this line. I think probably your most famous effort at balance was after you interviewed Al Franken.
Oh, yes.
He had just published his book on Fox and Bill O'Reilly. To balance that, being in the interest of fairness, you did an interview with Bill O'Reilly. In fact, most of the stuff about you that's on the internet is about your Bill O'Reilly interview. This was before he was sued by one of his producers for sexual harassment. What was it like to interview Bill O'Reilly?
Well, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk to him about was whether he thinks he uses his microphone to settle scores with people who have said something negative about him. He has something, I don't know if you watch the show, but he has something at the end of the show called Most Ridiculous Item of the Day. And sometimes it's like just a little like funny, silly thing that's happened. Often, though, it's him talking about how somebody's a coward because they're not coming on his show because they don't want to face his tough questions, or he'll ridicule the New York Times or the LA Times or a specific reporter that said something negative about himself or Fox News or another conservative. And I wanted to really press this with him. Like, does he use his microphone to settle scores? And at that point, he got really angry with me. And he said that I was being really unfair. I didn't treat Al Franken this way. I gave Al Franken an easy ride. Not that I think he'd actually heard or read the Al Franken interview, but mm-hmm. and then he actually terminated the interview. He was in another studio, and he just had his engineer turn his mic off, and that was it. You know, he just like turned off the mic and left after telling me that I should probably get out of the business.
Okay.
And I'm sure he thought that he really kind of gave it to me, you know, and he taught me a lesson. But, you know, we ran the whole interview. We ran him walking out, and then I came back and answered the full question that he refused to let me ask him. And we got such a huge response to it that in a lot of ways, I think he did me a big favor. I mean, I stand by the interview. As you and your listeners may know, our ombudsman at NPR basically agreed with O'Reilly that I was unfair to him because I treated Al Franken differently. I was more friendly to Al Franken, the ombudsman said, and I didn't ask him tough questions like I asked O'Reilly. But to quote Bill O'Reilly, who was once asked a similar question by one of his listeners, he said, "Different interviews demand different strategies." And I think you interview Al Franken differently than you interview Bill O'Reilly. And this was before Al Franken had his own radio show. This was before Air America went on the air.
It's a great story. We're speaking with Terry Gross. We need to take a short break now. Her new book is All I Did Was Ask, and we'll talk more with Terry Gross in a minute when our program continues. Welcome back. I'm John Wiener. We're speaking with Terry Gross. She's got a book out, All I Did Was Ask, Conversations with Writers, Actors, Musicians, and Artists. I wanted to ask you about your interviews with politicians who are trained to avoid answering real questions and instead hit their talking points and stay on message. Hillary Clinton was your guest when her book came out. I thought you tried really hard to get her to answer your questions, but I felt she defeated you. I wonder what your strategies are in getting political figures to really answer questions.
You know what my strategy is in interviewing politicians? To leave it to other people. I really don't enjoy interviewing politicians. Not that fresh air is supposed to be about my personal enjoyment, but I find it very, very frustrating. And I also often feel I'm the wrong person for the job. I think politicians are so wedded to their talking points, it's so hard to knock them off message. And the best way of doing it is to be following the beat, to be following them so closely that you know everything they've said and done, and you can call them on any exaggeration or any mistruth that they state. It's hard for me to do that. I'm not following them. I'm not covering the political beat. I'm doing a little bit of everything. So I usually don't even feel qualified in that sense to interview politicians.
Well, you interviewed Bill Clinton when his book came out, and that was more, I thought, of a real conversation. It was last June. You asked them about the culture wars. I listened to this again last night at your website, and I think that interview is more significant now after the election than it was when it aired. I wonder if you felt your interview with Bill turned out better than your interview with Hillary, and if so, why?
Well, I think it's easier to interview somebody when they're out of office,
okay.
particularly if they're not about to run for another office.
Yeah.
You know, Bill Clinton's goal during that interview, if he had a goal, was to promote his book, which means to be as interesting as possible.
Yes.
Whereas when somebody's in office, their goal is to stay in office and to get reelected in office. Mm-hmm. It's that whole permanent campaign. And so they're not going to go off message. And they're not going to, more often than not, I think they're not going to be really honest about what they face in office because they can't afford to alienate either voters or the people who they're trying to cut deals with in Congress. And that's the way the game is played. You have to cut deals. So when they get out of office, then maybe they can reflect a little bit about what the political world is really like. And that's why the truth is I prefer to interview politicians when their political career is behind them. Because then maybe they can actually tell you something.
Another of your most fascinating interviews was Nancy Reagan, who you talked to after she published her autobiography. How did that one go?
Well, I thought that that interview was going to be about me trying to get beneath her burnished veneer. But in fact, they're kind of wasn't a veneer. I mean, she seemed incredibly vulnerable and unprepared for challenging questions. I wanted to ask her about the things I felt she and her husband had neglected to respond to when they were in the White House. And I interviewed her when her memoir was published, so this was after they left the White House. I wanted to talk with her about the rise of homelessness, her Just Say No campaign. Did she really think peer pressure was an adequate way of getting poor young people in housing projects with no prospects for the future, you know, to say no to drugs? And AIDS, why did it take her so long? Why did it take her husband so long to acknowledge its existence? And when he did, why was he so clueless? So that was my agenda. And she just kept saying, I don't want to talk about politics. I'm not here to talk about politics. And she kept saying, have you read my book? I hope you've read the whole book. And it was astounding to me that a former first lady would say that she refuses to talk about politics. I mean, what does she think her memoir was about? You know, she'd written about her Just Say No campaign in the memoir. You know, it was ghostwritten, but, you know, I assumed that she had read it. And this might sound really harsh for me to be saying now, because Nancy Reagan, as we know her now, is a very, very vulnerable older woman, and I think we all feel for her loss. But at that time, she was fresh out of a very powerful position, and again, I feel it's perfectly appropriate to ask challenging questions to people who have held a lot of power.
We're speaking with Terry Gross about her new book, All I Did Was Ask. It includes interviews with writers, actors, musicians, and artists, some famous people and some really cool people. Let me ask you about one of the most famous interviews, which is transcribed in the book, Gene Simmons of the heavy metal group Kiss. You ran this interview on the radio. It's listed on your website, but when you click on that interview, instead you get the one with the guy from MC5 instead of Gene Simmons. What happened?
Well, he did not give us permission to use his interview on the website.
And why was that?
Well, I think he wants a cut of everything. You know, Gene Simmons during the interview said, I didn't want to be in a rock and roll band. I wanted to be in a rock and roll brand. And, you know, they market everything. I mean, there's a Kiss beer keg coffin.
Okay.
At Tower Records, they used to sell Kiss condoms. I mean, they just market everything. And if you're going to sell anything, and we sell transcripts, but we don't sell. Obviously, the website is free, but still, it's got his brand on it. And he just doesn't want to make anything available without am getting some money for it.
No, I guess there's a question that comes before this one. Why did you want to interview Gene Simmons of the heavy metal group Kiss? Mostly you interview really cool people like Sonny Rollins, Charlie Hayden, Bootsy Collins, George Clinton. Gene Simmons is not in that group. What were you hoping to get from Gene Simmons of Kiss?
Well, he had actually written a memoir that I thought had some truly interesting stuff in it that I had no idea about. You know, for example, Gene Simmons grew up until the age of 10 or 11 in Israel. His mother was a Holocaust survivor. He went to a yeshiva. When he moved to the United States, he was still going to yeshiva and wearing a yarmulke all the time. So the distance between the yeshiva and Kiss was a pretty far distance, and I thought that would be a pretty interesting journey to talk about.
Yeah.
You know, he came to America not knowing anything about American popular culture. And then for a lot of teenagers, he kind of defined a certain genre of music, you know, that kind of preteen heavy metal genre. And I thought this would really be fun to talk about. And I thought we'd share a laugh about what it's like now that he's in his 50s to still be strapping on the codpiece for performances.
Okay.
But we didn't share a laugh.
Well, why don't you tell us what happened?
Well, he has this image of NPR as being this kind of elitist, fussy, pretentious type of broadcasting. So, you know, he never met me, never heard my show, and we weren't in the same studio, so he wasn't seeing me. So he really had no idea who I was or anything. But nevertheless, he assumed that I was this kind of like dusty bookworm who, which has an element of truth to it, sadly. But anyway, so he said some pretty crass things like, "The message is, if you want to welcome me with open arms, I'm afraid you'll also have to welcome me with open legs."
Uh-huh.
Now, people don't usually talk to me that way on Fresh Air.
No.
So I had to ask myself, what do I do next? Do I say, as if I was a kindergarten teacher, "Mr. Simmons, if you continue to behave that way, this interview will not continue." Or do I just pretend like he never said that and try to bring it back on topic and say, "Well, getting back to your second album," or do I just say what I was really thinking? So I figured, just say what you're thinking. So I said, "This is like an incredibly obnoxious thing to say. Is this like the only shtick that you have when you talk to women? Are you incapable of just like talking to a woman without doing that shtick?" And so we ended up just insulting each other for the rest of the interview.
And then you actually aired that interview.
Yeah. We didn't know if we would air it or not. We actually put it on a shelf for a few weeks, because we didn't know, was this an interesting disaster or merely a disaster? And we figured we needed to just put some space between the shock of the interview and making the decision. So when we listened to the interview a few weeks later, we thought, you know, we're not going to win the Peabody Award for this, but it's going to be interesting radio. And it was. I mean, we got thousands of emails.
Yes, it was. So, Terry Gross, your book, All I Did Was Ask, has about three dozen transcribed interviews. Of course, there's a big difference between listening to an interview and reading one. Mainly, we don't hear the voice. And one of the great things about Fresh Air is the voices. Samuel Jackson has an incredible voice.
Yeah, I agree.
James Baldwin has an incredible voice. Johnny Cash had an incredible voice. They're all here in the book on the printed page. I wonder what you thought when the project came up of transcribing these and losing the voice and turning them into print.
I was really worried about that. You know, I was basically drag kicking and screaming into doing the book. I really didn't want to do it, in part because my goal in life is to try to work less, and doing a book didn't seem to be congruent with that goal.
No.
So,
no.
But after years of refusing to do it, even though everything was all, you know, even though the publisher wanted it, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, I finally decided to go ahead with it. Yeah, and then I faced that question of, like, what will it be like without the voice? But the goal was to find the interviews that were actual reading experiences, that would actually be a good reading experience. And I think we managed to do that.
I think you did succeed. And there is one thing you can do when you're reading, which is you can slow down. You can pause. You can go back.
Exactly. And I found that a lot of things registered on me when I was reading these interviews that went right past me when I was actually recording them. You know, a lot of interviews that I remembered as being really good, without the voice and without the person there, they didn't work on the page. But I think the ones we chose do. And then another difference between, you know, the radio interviews and the print interviews, punctuation.
Ah, yes.
Oh, man, suddenly it was like, is this a comma or a semicolon or a dash? You know? Mm-hmm. So it required a lot of, like, going back to, like, the style books and really kind of thinking a lot about, do people talk in semicolons or do they talk in dashes? And that was interesting.
We've only got a couple minutes left here. What is the deal with rumors that you are a lesbian?
You tell me. Well, here's what I think it is. Yes, I've had people go up to... can I have time for a funny story?
Sure.
I was at a reception with my husband. He had gotten a grant, and my mother-in-law was with us, and somebody went up to my mother-in-law, not knowing who she was, pointed to me and said, look over there, that's Terry Gross. Did you know she's a lesbian? And my mother-in-law thought that was really a scream. She thought it was really funny.
Mm-hmm.
I get invited to be parts of, you know, I've gotten invited to be in the lesbian who's who and everything. So I have to say, well, you have to be a lesbian to be in it, because if you do, then I can't be in it. If you don't, then, you know, I'm flattered, that's fine. I think people have assumed, that a lot of people have assumed I'm gay for, I think the main reason is we have done a lot of gay-themed interviews on the show. We've done a lot of interviews with gay artists and gay people in many different professions, talking about what it's like to be gay, talking about gay culture. You know, I think...
There's a great one in the book with that woman who wrote the pulp gay novels of the 50s and 60s.
Oh, Anne Bannon, yeah.
Fantastic interview.
Yeah, oh, thanks. I think she's wonderful. She wrote... Anne Bannon is a pen name, and that's the name she wrote under in the 50s when she was one of the first people to write lesbian pulp. But, you know, I think a lot of people assume perhaps that because I'm comfortable talking with gay people about gay issues and about gay art and et cetera, that therefore I'm gay, in the same way that I think a lot of people assume I must be a musician because I love talking to musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And I seem to know something about music, therefore, a lot of people assume maybe I'm a writer because I love talking to writers. So, you know, in that sense, I'm actually really flattered, you know. And then I have a short haircut, so maybe that plays.
Maybe that's it. Okay, last question. On this book tour, you've experienced the joys of being the guest instead of the host. That means you get to explain what's interesting and maybe important about you. You get to talk about yourself, which is something that you don't do when you're the host. So now that you've had the experience, which role do you like better, the interviewee or the interviewer?
Definitely the interviewer. You know, it's actually a lot more interesting for me to talk with people about their lives and about their work and their art and their area of expertise than it is for me to talk about myself, I guess in part because I already know about myself. And it's more interesting for me to be learning about other people. And in a way, that's why I am an interviewer, because I like to be learning about other people and about things that I don't know. And that's something I don't accomplish when I'm talking about myself.
Well, Terry Gross's new book is All I Did Was Ask, Conversations with Writers, Actors, Musicians, and Artists. Terry, thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you, John, and I'm a great admirer of your work. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
It's been great.